The Transport Revolution departing platform 12. Doors closing. Stand clear, please. Stand clear.
We're talking infrastructure.
The Transport Revolution.
We're talking optimal solution.
The Transport Revolution.
We're talking whatever it takes.
The Transport Revolution.
New South Wales, have we got plans for you?
For the last 13 years, there's been a soap opera running in the New South Wales government, starring the Labor premiers, Bob Carr, Maurice Yemmer and Nathan Rees. It's a drama set in Sydney's Western Fringe, a place with more cars per household than any other. And they've got no choice, because while the government has been good at promising marvellous railways, all they've delivered is a series of ghost trains. 1,000 people a day are moving to Sydney's west. There'll be 500,000 more in the next 15 to 20 years. In 1998, Bob Carr promised the northwest would get their railway by 2010.
In fact, this investment is so big that it represents the foundations for public transport for this city in the next century.
And while his government was good at announcements, by the time Bob Carr quit politics in 2004, not one sleeper had been laid, and the government's credibility with voters was wearing thin. Enter a new premier, Maurice Yemmer, and he repeatedly reassured voters that the railways were coming. And for good measure, he even announced another one out to the southwestern outskirts, where a city the size of Canberra would soon grow. And then one day in March this year, the Premier decided that the people of the northwest deserved something much better than a railway, and he came up with an underground metro.
Today is the biggest day in the history of public transport in New South Wales, because today we start a public transport revolution.
It was to have been a $12 billion project and would have gobbled up virtually all of the rail capital budget. No one believed it would ever get built. And last month, it was axed by yet another Labor Premier, Nathan Rees. So too was that other billion-dollar railway out to the city's southwestern fringe. The New South Wales government's railway revolution, its grand plans to build railways to Sydney's west, is a spectacular train wreck. According to the New South Wales Auditor-General's report, released last week, the motorways are choked. A trip driving from A to B takes longer than it did 12 months ago. Without a mass transport solution, peak hour will last all day. Seen from outer space, Sydney is drowning in gridlock, bitumen and road rage, and it's costing a fortune. But the new Premier has an ace up his sleeve. It's called the Rudd Bank, low dock loans and infrastructure funds. It might just save the New South Wales Labor government, and it won't do Kevin Rudd any harm either.
We're talking infrastructure. Infra-Rudd structure. Infra-Ruddy structure. Watch out!
There'll be trains everywhere.
Red hot rattlers.
It's all brilliant.
Currently isolated. Just you.
Hello, I'm Wendy Carlisle, and this is Background Briefing on ABC Radio National. On the 24th of October, Premier Nathan Rees, just 6 weeks into the job, announced his very own vision for the city.
Today, Nathan Rees revealed his vision.
Do we have the plan? The map? Okay.
The government's plan has changed. It's now spruiking a CBD metro from Central Station to Rozelle, with four stops along the way.
This makes Metro the future of passenger transport in Greater Metropolitan Sydney.
Nathan Rees says the project is of national significance, and he's asked Infrastructure Australia for full federal funding of $4 billion.
They got it. They got the vision bit about where this fits.
In Canberra, Kevin Rudd is watching all this very carefully, and what he can see is that if New South Wales goes down the gurgler, it could take his government with it. So important is the New South Wales economy that unless efficient mass transport systems are built, it will hinder its ability to survive a recession. The consequences, politically and economically for Mr Rudd, will be dire. Already New South Wales is being compared, perhaps a little cruelly, to a failed state. And like the Northern Territory intervention, minus the army, the doctors and the nurses, the federal government is being asked to intervene. Nathan Rees wants Canberra to pay for a new CBD metro running through a batch of Labor seats. He also wants it to pay for another Western metro out to Parramatta, also another batch of Labor seats. And if there's anything left, he'd like the Rudd Bank to build the Northwest Metro out to the Liberal stronghold in the Northwest. Nathan Rees's vision for a CBD metro has come completely out of the blue and has never been part of any earlier plan for the city. Meantime, the ditching of the Northwest Metro has left people on the city fringe deeply upset, not least of all the folk at Rouse Hill. One of Sydney's newest master planned communities, in the 1990s, Rouse Hill was an old brickworks site. Now it's home to 80,000 residents, and there'll be 200,000 more in the next 10 to 15 years. So determined was the Carr government to plan for railways that the developers were required to include a railway station in their master plan. If the railway hadn't been axed, it would have been built right underneath the shopping centre, which is where Background Briefing found some unhappy shoppers.
And I came out here to build a nice big house, etc., in affordability, and now that they've canned the rail link, it's disgusting. What are we going to do? There's nothing out here. You can't move people to A to B around this area. We're being ripped off by the tolls and the M2. I'm paying $6,000 a year for tolls.
$6,000 a year?
That's right, $6,000 a year on tolls alone. And there's no cashback system like they do have on the M4, so the Rees government has absolutely let all the people down out here in the area.
The departure of Premier Yemma and two of his ministers in October triggered a series of disastrous by-elections for the government, the biggest swings against a government in post-war history. The bellwether seat of Ryde fell to the Liberals. Within weeks, the new Rees government was not looking good. A police minister was sacked after dancing in his underpants, and then another head rolled.
The Premier, Nathan Rees, says he won't be afraid to sack more of his ministers if they misbehave, even if it means he's the only person left on the front bench. Mark Tobin reports from State Parliament.
Nathan Rees sacked his Assistant Health Minister Tony Stewart yesterday. He's now saying it may have been a mistake to elevate the MP to Cabinet in the first place.
Hindsight's always 20/20.
He also had this warning for his ministers.
I don't mind if, in order to uphold the standards that I require of my Cabinet, there's one of us left.
Against this drama, the bad news on Sydney's trains just kept getting worse. As congestion worsened, costing $12 million a day, more and more people were piling onto already jam-packed trains.
Keep moving forward.
At Sydney's main CBD stations, Wynyard and Town Hall, there were fears that surging crowds could push commuters onto the tracks, and marshals were brought in to manage the situation.
The Transport Revolution departing platform 12.
Some of the new trains were too long for platforms. Rear guards doors opened onto thin air. The new trains for the Chatswood Tunnel were so noisy they sounded like Boeings coming into land. Decades of mismanagement and political dithering were coming home to roost. Bob Carr must have been thinking he got out just in time.
Call 13 16 16 or visit...
Sydney radio host Alan Jones picked up the Daily Telegraph on Tuesday the 18th of November and gleefully read out the bad news.
Well, absolute disaster. Nathan Rees wakes up this morning and he gets up early. He's out there in Western Sydney. And the Daily Telegraph run a banner story today that close to three-fifths of state Labor MPs risk being thrown out at the next election. I mean, if this keeps going, it'll be a one-party government. Barry O'Farrell will win every seat. The ALP General Secretary Matt Thistlewaite is quoted as saying, as having started work on the campaign for the 2011 election, and delivered the news in a series of briefings for MPs last week. He's quoted as saying, "I don't know of anything we can do or recommend to reverse this? Well, I do. I mean, you just say we've listened and you call it all off.
At 40, Nathan Rees, the former Garbo with a literature degree, had been in the Parliament for just 18 months when he became Premier.
Turning 40 is probably a bit easier than the last 10 weeks, but no, it's
within hours, he'd brought in Alex Cram, the chief media strategist behind the Kevin 07 campaign, to style the new government. And that means carefully managing the Premier, especially now when in the next week, New South Wales nervously waits to see if the Prime Minister will come up with the goodies. Nathan Rees declined to be interviewed for this program. By the time he goes to the polls in 2011, he'll be asking voters for 20 years of unbroken Labor rule. And like a good fighter, Nathan Rees knows attack is the best defence. He's been accusing the opposition for what he says is their lack of transport policy.
You will not get away. The people of New South Wales will not let you get away with this drivel. This is drivel, you know it. Almost 2 years now, not a single policy. The people of New South Wales will not let you get away with this.
His seat, Premier, I'll ask the Premier to resume his seat. I'll ask the Premier to resume his seat. I'm not sure what everybody had for lunch today. Order. But we are barely 5 minutes in question time. And the conduct has been, in my view, appalling.
By them?
By the House. And I'll say this, that I am now going to look very closely at asking members to leave the chamber. Don't test me.
Senior business leaders are also being tested. Speaking on Channel 10's Meet the Press program, one prominent member of the Federal Government's Infrastructure Australia Board recommended that Kevin Rudd send the administrators into New South Wales. From the Australian industry group, Heather Ridout.
Look, I think New South Wales isn't a New South Wales issue. It's a national issue. It's 33% of the Australian economy, although that percentage seems to be falling as we speak. And that budget, which put up taxes, deferred infrastructure investment, it just defies reason. And, you know, again, it's like this silly deficit argument. It's all about politics. It's about protecting AAA ratings or some sort of issue there. I think Kevin Rudd needs to take New South Wales aside from the COAG process and work out what we need to do to fix this state and what conditions need to be put on it. A bit like an administrator going into a local council and saying, well, let's have a look at the books. Let's have a really good look at what's going on here and fix it. And I think
also on Kevin Rudd's Infrastructure Australia board is Professor Peter Newman, a respected public transport thinker. He's got hindsight on New South Wales because in the 90s, he was the state's sustainability commissioner. And what he saw still makes his hair stand on end.
There are certain features of a failed state about New South Wales in the sense that if you have competing factions, not just political factions, competing silos within the bureaucracy that don't talk to each other, then it's very hard to get unified solutions that can be implemented.
In the 1990s, when Bob Carr was touting his ambitious rail projects, Peter Newman saw the political wing make an announcement and then the Treasury hardheads scuttle it.
So one particular faction gets up an announcement and then the next faction undermines it the next day. That's the kind of thing I found operating in Sydney, which completely shocked me, actually, because I'm not aware of that in the other states.
Peter Newman says the New South Wales government has to sort out who's in control before it makes big announcements.
If you announce it before having all that discussion, then it gets undermined later. And that tends to have been the way in which a lot of these government agencies have operated. They haven't had a coherent ability to have one policy that everybody agrees on and then gets down to doing it.
You've called New South Wales a failed state there. Is there a sense that Infrastructure Australia is kind of the federal intervention we had to have?
Well, I think that Infrastructure Australia is the federal intervention that all states had to have. There isn't any doubt in my mind that the processes of infrastructure provision were inadequate in all states. The Sydney one is particularly obvious, and I hope that Sydney's future will be better after this process and that there will be a far more coherent and integrated approach.
When Bob Carr was elected in 1995, he used the economic sunshine to knock off billions of dollars in state debt. He signed what he thought were fantastic contracts to build roads and tunnels at no cost to the taxpayer. Although we now know they were bad contracts, and now they're burning a huge hole in state finances. Professor Newman said Treasury loved the private financing models, the PPPs, and were positively allergic to spending taxpayers' money.
Public transport was somehow seen to be something that you could do away with. Extraordinary ideas that economists had in that period, and they're now, you can't find them, of course. Everybody's talking infrastructure. It's the new kind of black, isn't it? Everything has to be infrastructure and it's going to solve all our problems. An extraordinary change in economic thinking, but certainly state government treasuries that I was dealing with through the 80s and 90s, they saw it like swearing in church if you suggested that we do something to improve the rail system. I mean, these were just a drain on the economy.
With tollways all the go, the focus was on cars, not trains.
If you replaced Sydney's rail system going into the CBD, you would have to construct 60 lanes of freeway to replace that. The city would just dissolve in bitumen. It's just stupid to think that you can run a modern, large, dense city without an effective urban rail system. You can't do it. You end up like Detroit, which is laced with beautiful freeways going to the city centre, and nothing is there. It's just car park.
No fuss. Hop on the Bendy Bus. A transport revolution. I'd be happy to use them myself. We'll give it a red hot go. A bold new vision. Completely transparent. Fully functional. We're not getting off at Redfern. We're going all the way.
For most of the time Bob Carr was Premier, his mere presence was positively gubernatorial. And while the opposition shuffled through leaders and struggled to cut through, the Premier, while he wasn't hosting literary events, developed the habit of calling newsrooms and telling journalists what to write, and even giving them the grabs to go with it.
Bob Carr, got that tape rolling.
Yeah, what's that quality like, James?
It's fine, thank you.
And clear?
Yep, good. Absolutely.
Okay, well, you can say the Premier Bob Carr said this morning the government would proceed with its bed tax proposal as part of the budget legislation in the state upper house. I'll give you a grab to go with that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we've asked the... Start again. We're asking the taxpayers to put $620 million into Olympic construction this year, and at the same time we as a government are putting computers into schools and expanding the hospital's budget and putting extra police on the beat. Frankly, the big city hotels ought to be making a modest contribution to a budget that funds the Olympics but maintains essential social infrastructure.
When ABC journalist James Walker attempted to actually interview the Premier, the response was classic Bob Carr.
So there won't be any negotiation?
No. See you later.
OK.
Bye. Bye.
Can't believe that.
For nearly 50 years, the governments of New South Wales have lived off the legacy of railways laid down in yesteryears. But Sydney has outgrown its past. If you superimposed a map of Sydney in the 1950s with today, you'd see two entirely different places. The bulk of Sydneysiders now live in what wasn't Sydney 50 years ago, but our public transport systems have barely changed, and the public buses and trains still run the same routes they used to 50 years ago. Out west, cars are king. From the University of Western Sydney, Dr. Gabrielle Gwither.
And this is after the Second World War, there was a big push for new houses for the soldiers that were returning, for the slum clearance, which was poorer people were living in sort of the slums around Alexandria, Enmore and all those sorts of places. And, of course, for the migrants, the big non-English-speaking migrant period started after the Second World War. And so Western Sydney was deemed to be the place that you would develop for low-income people, and that's sort of the way that it has developed. The infrastructure, it was never advanced at the same time that new little suburbs were sort of springing up.
The new suburbs sometimes lacked basic infrastructure.
Basic things like curb guttering, parks for kids, the footpaths, you know, that's local government, so they couldn't keep up with the growth. So there are still places in Western Sydney, for instance, out the back of Liverpool, which still doesn't have curb and guttering, and it was, you know, the first settlers moved in there 40 years ago.
It wasn't just curbs and guttering either. In 1972, Gough Whitlam, the member for Werriwa, an electorate in Sydney's west, embarked on his own nation-building projects. Here he is speaking in 2002 on the 30th anniversary of the election of his government.
One could not represent an electorate like Werriwa without being acutely aware that a family's standard of living was determined by where it lived as much as by its income. We have reverted to the attitude expressed by John Gorton when I argued that sewerage was a national issue. He accused me of talking not like an aspirant for the Prime Ministership, but like a Shire President. I took that as a compliment, the more so because he had actually been a Shire President. I prefer, however, Neville Rand's compliment. It was said of Caesar Augustus that he found Rome brick and left it marble. It will be said of Gough Whitlam that he found the outer suburbs of Sydney, Melbourne and Brisbane unsewered and left them fully flushed.
The people out west got their sewers and then they got their own radio station. For the next 30 years, successive governments pushed more and more people out west. And without the public transport, people relied on their cars. In the newer master-planned estates, it wasn't uncommon to see a triple-car garage in every house in the street. Labor's mantra was planning to support Sydney's future growth. The Carr and Yemma governments planned for two new growth areas out west, where cities the size of Canberra and Wollongong would go. And eager not to repeat the mistakes of the past, determined to put railways out there. The politician driving all this under the Yemma government was the abrasive, can-do planning minister, Frank Sartor. In September last year, he fielded a perfect Dorothy Dixer about what he was doing to put new railways out west, and he smacked it right back at the opposition.
These will be the major transport arteries. See, they don't want to hear good news. They hate good news. They hate it. They hate good news. And you, I've got more. These will be the major transport arteries connecting 181,000 new homes planned for Sydney's growth centres, making it easier for workers to commute and quicker for them to return home to their families.
As the Speaker pulled the House into order, you can hear, if you listen closely, the Premier, Morris Yemma, asking Minister Sartor to get to the point. New South Wales has a plan. Sartor responds, "Don't worry, I'm coming to that."
What's your plan?
The members of the opposition will stop calling out.
Thank you for your assistance, Mr. Speaker. All these projects strengthen the economy, support jobs, and they make life easier or safer or more convenient for hard-working families. That's why the government is investing a record $10 billion in infrastructure each year through the State Infrastructure Strategy. We have a plan to secure the state's future. The opposition has no plan. No plan. Nothing. Zip. Zilch. Niente. Niente.
6 months after Sartor's spray, Morris Yemma upgraded the North West Railway to a metro. It would have been the biggest public works project in New South Wales history. A grand vision like that was indeed worth shouting about, and ads like these began appearing on television.
The New South Wales government's improved transport strategy includes a new underground rail link from Sydney's northwest under Victoria Road to the city. It's a quick, efficient, Euro-style train service running every few minutes to get you there faster.
But when the Sydney property bubble started to burst and the state's finances took a perilous dive, Treasurer Michael Costa ordered an emergency mini-budget. Costa, a long-time opponent of public transport, warned that building the North West Metro would wreck the state's credit rating. And while the government was reeling from its failure to privatise electricity, the next plot point in this long-running soap was being written. Within 24 hours, there'd be a new premier and the departure of some of the more colourful ministers. First, Maurice Yemma decided that the abrasive, divisive Michael Costa was a luxury he could no longer afford. Such were the atmospherics within government at this time that when Costa announced he'd been dumped, he almost started to laugh.
I was advised last night by the Premier he didn't want me on his ticket. What happens in caucus is up to caucus.
As it turned out, nobody wanted the Premier either. He demanded the right to reshape his cabinet and the caucus refused. For the first time in Labor history, a reigning Premier was forced to walk the plank.
They didn't want to do it my way. They can get on without me.
The North West Metro, on the other hand, was, according to the outgoing Premier, one of his finest achievements.
The North West has to happen. The metros are the way of the future in public transport for this state, and they've got to happen. Now, is it easy delivering them? No. Because the easiest decision was to stick with the current system. So, metros are going to happen. They must happen for the sake of this state's future. They've got to happen, no matter who's Premier.
Within hours, the new Premier, Nathan Rees, set about blaming the crash in the government's fortunes on his predecessors. A new episode in the soap opera had begun.
Today we start the process of restoring public confidence in the administration of this state. I will be having a red-hot go at fixing the problems in New South Wales and giving you the services and the standard of services that you, as taxpayers, are entitled to.
With Reserve Bank Governor Glenn Stevens urging the states to borrow and spend big on infrastructure to avoid recession, the New South Wales government had other ideas. It was priming itself to return to surplus in time for the next election. One of the first things Nathan Rees did was axe the North West Metro. It was, he said, unaffordable and not a priority. But he didn't deliver the bad news himself. He gave that job to his Transport Minister, David Campbell.
Well, as I say, good afternoon. I can, this afternoon, confirm reports in the media this morning that as part of the mini-budget process, a decision has been taken to defer the North West Metro. That's a decision taken in the context of the state's financial position, in the context of what everybody can see coming in terms of the world economy.
As for what all those TV ads promoting the new metro actually cost, the minister didn't have an answer.
I don't know that figure, but it's certainly not one of our finest hours.
Instead of their $10 billion metro, David Campbell said the people of the North West could have 100 buses worth $150 million. Out west, people said they never believed the metro was coming anyway.
I think they G'd everybody up and made everybody believe that it was going to happen, and I think some people got a bit excited about it, but, yeah, I don't
especially,
think
I suppose, when the ads were on telly and everything.
Yeah, well, they made it look really fantastic, didn't they? And I don't know, it's just sort of the usual with the government, isn't it? They promise something and they don't follow up with it.
Did you believe that the railway was coming when you saw the ads on telly?
At first, I sort of thought, oh, wow, that'd be great, and then I sort of thought twice about it and went, nah.
Meanwhile, back at the New South Wales Parliament, an alliance of Greens, the Shooters Party and coalition members had forced through an upper house inquiry into the transport needs of the North West. They hoped this would be a most embarrassing experience for the government. It received hundreds of submissions, including one from the Premier's department, which was still spruiking the North West Metro, even though it had been axed 2 weeks before. The stage was set. The script was written. Liberal MP Ray Williams can be heard here exchanging views with his colleague David Clark.
The people of the North West area have been lied to
for the past 15 years by this New South Wales state government. It is a disgrace. It is a disgrace that no departments are here today to answer to this inquiry as to why the corridor and the plans and the money that has been spent, and indeed the literature, the brochures and the TV advertising that has been spent on the North West Rail Link to date, why the RTA is not here, why the State Rail is not here, why the Ministry for Planning or the Ministry for Transport are not here to answer as to why they have been party to that advertising to the people of the North West sector, why they have not turned up here today, why the New South Wales government has not allowed them to appear here today. I think those questions need to be answered, and I think for the people of the North West is an absolute disgrace, one, that this rail link is now not going to be built at all, and a disgrace that the New South Wales government has not here to answer for its actions.
You are aware that we asked these departments to attend here today, Mr Williams?
I'm not aware of that, Mr Clark.
It was classic agitprop theatre. Both Ray Williams and David Clark knew full well the government had cancelled its appearance. Their explanation was that they were busy with the mini-budget. Also appearing before the inquiry were representatives from local councils. From the Western Sydney Regional Councils Organisation, Alex Gooding.
In our submission, we refer to the fact that you could argue that this amounts to entrenched discrimination against the people of Western Sydney. For example, since the 1930s, there's only been about 14 kilometres of rail added in Western Sydney. In that time, we've had over 100 kilometres of motorway added. And we're not saying that we didn't need those motorways, but there's been a failure to balance that investment with investment in rail infrastructure. It's also important to point out...
3 weeks later, senior bureaucrats gave evidence before the inquiry, this time with an amended submission. The government had announced that instead of the North West Metro, there would be 100 extra buses. But Baulkham Hills Mayor Larry Bolitho said he didn't think these were new buses at all.
Are you saying that those buses that were announced the other day are really just re-announcement?
We understand it are a re-announcement of what was already previously announced, correct?
Yeah, okay.
That's our understanding.
Sure.
In the northwest of the city, there are two choices to get around, buses or cars. For outsiders, those not familiar with the peculiar location of local bus stops, it can be very confusing. Russian couple Boris and Evgeny hail from Sydney's eastern suburbs. But when they spotted a bargain leather lounge at a shopping centre on Old Windsor Road, they headed out west, first by train to Parramatta and then by bus up Windsor Road. They got the lounge, but the trip back home was a nightmare. By the time Background Briefing encountered Evgeny, she was shading herself with an upturned umbrella beside a windy, noisy Old Windsor Road. She stopped to ask me if I'd seen Boris, her husband, who disappeared up the road in search of the bus stop. I'd seen him heading off up a bike track beside the road cutting, and using my mobile, she called him and told him to come back.
Where are you? Come back. Иди назад. Okay. Thank you.
So he's going to come back now?
Evgeny explained they couldn't find the bus stop heading back to Parramatta.
Okay, okay. So just let me get this one again. You came through on the bus?
Yeah, it was bus stop here opposite. Look.
She said even in Russia, there are bus stops on opposite sides of the road.
Usually. If you come from this side, back usually opposite, but here nice.
So that's the bus station over there that you got off?
Yeah.
And you walked over there to the...
shopping centre?
No, or whatever. And then you come back to catch the bus back to Parramatta?
Yeah.
And there's no bus stop?
No bus stop, I don't know how. It's amazing. Usually it's not a big problem. Where is he? No... So far ago.
I saw him wandering up this bike road looking for the bus station.
As it happened, I drove them back to Parramatta Station. Early each morning, hundreds of commuters in the northwest form orderly queues to get on city-bound buses. At 7:30 a.m. one day, Background Briefing joined them at Castle Hill to gauge what the local reaction was to the cancellation of the railway.
Finding that the government's increasing the density of the housing in the area
With a view to there being a better transport system out here, but now that there's not going to be, more than likely, there's more and more cars on the road. And so that's just exacerbating the problem because the bus system isn't enough, more people are driving. And so consequently, the traffic on the road's worse.
So there's going to be more people living out here and...
less options. So it's just making the problem worse. They're trying to push more people on the buses, but there aren't enough buses. So what can be done? But catch up.
Okay.
Thanks. Thank you.
Another commuter said she sees buses flying past full and leaving stranded commuters behind.
I often quite notice all the queues of people lined up at the bus stops along Old Northern Road, and the buses just fly past them because they're already full before they've even gotten halfway down this street, sort of thing. So, yes, I do sympathise with them, yes.
Thank you. And, well, the government says they're putting on a couple of hundred new buses. Do you think that's going to help things?
No, we really need a railway of some description out here, something more efficient than... I mean, the buses are trying, I suppose, but we really need a rail link of some sort.
Back down the freeway to where Baulkham Hills has its huge council chambers, Mayor Larry Bolitho, who you heard earlier, was showing me some old photos of the old Baulkham Hills railway station, now long gone.
Well, we actually had a station at Baulkham Hills in 1924.
1924, and where did the train go?
It came up at almost all the way to Castle Hill, but that's all gone now. Disappeared, taken out. It was basically a steam train type situation. So we, in fact, did have some growth of the railway system, but it's gone back to what it was on the 1st of August 1901 when they opened the station at Carlingford on the Rosehill to Carlingford thing under the Simpsons Railway Act of 1893.
Mayor Bolitho wonders how his area will cope with twice as many people in the next 20 years.
A railway or a metro, that in fact with that provision of public transport we could sustain a higher density without the corresponding increase in vehicle capacity of those individual streets. Now, all of that has now been thrown into chaos.
He's asked the government for a $230 million rescue package just to deal with the collateral damage from axing the railway. Things like widening roads, building car parks and more bus interchanges.
The anecdotal evidence that we're picking up and seeing at the major bus stops in the Shire is that the queues are much longer, the number of buses that are in the holding pattern to get into the bus stops is increasing, but even at the other points of destination there are problems.
Because when you're on a bus and you actually get into the city, you get to Wynyard and so on, it's a traffic jam.
Oh, well, it's going to be a bus jam now.
And here's the band as it comes marching down Elizabeth Street towards the old Camden Railway Station.
Sydney's other area slated for a population explosion is in the southwest, in Camden and Macquarie Fields. Already the roads are congested, and news that the railway had been indefinitely deferred had not been received well at all. 73-year-old Harold Pollard has lived in Camden most of his life, and he was looking forward to the new train service. He can remember back to a time when the area had a train. That was in 1963. And at his home in South Camden, he showed me a Super 8 movie of the day the last train pulled out of Camden. And as the flickering images jogged his memory, he told me how he'd led the Camden Big Band to farewell the old train.
Everybody in Camden turned out, did they?
Well, I don't know about everybody, but quite a few did. Because, you know, it was a historical event. The train had been running for years and suddenly it was all going to end. So quite a lot of people did turn out. Cars came from everywhere. There's the old train. Used to have the milk carriages on board that they'd stop at the milk depot, which is... oh, it was back there, but they'd fill up the tankers with milk and transport it to Sydney, but this is Campbelltown. We were waiting. We raced over and waited for it to arrive.
It's on its way, folks, so I'll just get the point set, and they'll bring it into the...
I just had a bit of fun putting some sound on it.
So
So the train went to Campbelltown, and then from Campbelltown, could you get into the city in those days?
Oh, you'd transfer onto a city-bound train from Campbelltown, and then this train here just reversed its engine and then did its next run back to Camden and just went backwards and forwards to
Camden. So it was a single line?
It was a single line, yes. Went over Kenny's Hill, which I believe at the time was the steepest gradient in New South Wales. Very often, I used to travel to Tech on it at night, and very often it would get halfway up the hill and the wheels would slip and I'd have to let it run back down and have another attempt again. Yeah. It wasn't such a big hill, but apparently it was the steepest gradient in the state at the time.
As for the train now being cancelled, well, Harold's pretty annoyed. He didn't really want a big new development spoiling his sleepy rural landscape. But if progress was going to happen, the train had to be part of it.
If we were going to have this first forced development upon us, then we had to make sure that it would work. And it would only work if we had the infrastructure here for getting people into the city. I mean, the two main roads out of here towards the city now, the Rowland Road and the Cow Pasture Road, at peak hours, they're both just chock-a-block. And that's the existing population. You know, when we get all this development, it's just going to make the situation much worse.
Meantime, it's full steam ahead with the construction of Sydney's new southwestern townships. 10 kilometres up the road from Harold Pollard's place is the Oran Park Raceway, Sydney's premier racing circuit, home to Peter Brock Drive and the V8 supercar races. But the future of Oran Park is not rubber and racing cars, it's mums, dads and new homes. Background Briefing arrived for the turning of the first sod just in time. Western Sydney identity Tony Perich has turned his Oran Park Raceway and the surrounding paddocks into the biggest residential development seen in Sydney for a decade. When the government rezoned the area, he found himself sitting on a parcel of land worth over $600 million.
This is the start of our Oran Park town. We are actually not going to put a spade in it. This is a very big project, so we're going to put in really big spades and we're going to wave a flag as though we're going to start as we are at Oran Park. It's never been done before. The project's so big, we want to do it different.
News that the railway has been deferred doesn't worry Tony Perich too much. He believes it will all come in good time. And waving the checkered flag to begin the ceremonial turning of the first sod was the new planning minister, Christina Keneally. Background Briefing wanted to know if the minister was at all embarrassed now that the railway was off.
Not at all, and let's be clear, the South West Rail Link has been deferred. We continue to hold the land that we've already purchased for it. We continue to buy new land for the rail link.
But there is no start date for stage two, is there?
At the moment, there is no start date, but we, as I've said, and we are continuing to purchase the land for that rail link. We continue to plan for it as part of our infrastructure strategy.
The government has set no date for recommencing the railway. The interim solution is roads and buses. One player in the mix is the former New South Wales Labor Council Secretary, Michael Eason. These days, he's an executive at Leighton Holdings, one of Australia's biggest construction companies. Eason has long harboured a plan to build a fast train out to Penrith in Sydney's far west, bringing it within 20 minutes of the city centre. After repeated submissions, he's concerned that his project has now been sidelined. He thinks the main problem is that the government hasn't really thought through the problems.
I don't really know why some solutions are put forward that struck me as eccentric or not well considered. I just don't know. I think there seems to be a lack of diligent planning within the process. I know that the people involved are wanting to do the right thing. It just seemed to me to be a breakdown in thinking about what are the problems to be solved. And I think the key problem is Western Sydney gets a poor deal for public transport. Western Sydney is where the growth is. Western
Sydney. He says Sydney needs a big open debate about what its public transport needs are, but he doesn't see it happening.
I think this idea of secrecy and non-transparency and non-public involvement in the generation of solution is poor planning. It's been the case for decades in New South Wales. It needs to change.
There are bigger political dimensions to this story. Researchers in Queensland have been working out ways of measuring the stress on families on the fringes of the big Australian cities, places where public transport is almost non-existent. They've come up with an index that measures housing affordability alongside petrol prices. And what that all means is that the car-dependent suburbs are the most vulnerable in recession, not just economically, but politically and socially as well. As Dr. Jago Dodson points out, federal governments rise and fall on the fortunes of the outer suburbs of the big cities like Sydney.
Yeah, well, I mean, when political commentators talk about the success of the Howard government in the late 1990s, they often talk about the battlers who switched to Howard and turfed out Labor. But those battlers then suddenly became aspirational voters as they took on large debts in order to afford outer suburban housing and became relatively prosperous or felt relatively prosperous because they had a decent-sized house, they had good jobs, unemployment was falling. It was a time where prosperity seemed easily accessible and available to most people in our cities. But then the climate turned, the fuel prices started to go up, mortgage interest rates were tracking upwards, and that prosperity started to be a bit clouded by those factors. And I think the Labor Party was quite clever in picking up in that switch between 2004 and 2007 amongst the mood of the suburban electorates in Australia, that things weren't quite as prosperous as they'd been told they were.
Yeah, they plugged into an anxiety, didn't they?
And the prosperity had come out of a lot of hard work on the part of most people, that even if you can go and get a big loan, you still have to work pretty hard to pay it off. And as the cost of transport and mortgage repayments increased, people were having to work harder and harder, or were feeling that they were seeing less return for the hard work that they were putting in. And I think that contributed to a bit of a change in the mood of the electorate, a bit more anxiety, a bit of uncertainty, sort of an unsettling of suburbia. And I think the Labor Party were able to tap into that quite well and convert those aspirational voters into the working families that we heard a great deal about during the 2007 election campaign.
The transport revolution departing platform 12. Doors closing. Stand clear, please. Fully endorsed by Bob Morris, Nathan, Parliament House, Sydney. User-friendly, reliable and convenient, on-time running, total flexibility, enjoy it every day, lifts or ramps, quick, efficient, with a great customer focus. Who's coming for a trip out west? City Loop goes round and round. Has anyone seen my tea card? Oh, shit. Is that the end of the line already?
Background Briefing's coordinating producer is Linda McGuinness. Research, Anna Whitfeld. Technical operator, Timothy Nicastri. The song, The Transport Revolution, was written and performed by KJ and Big Swifty, otherwise known as Kerry Jean Ross and Carl Polk. Background Briefing's executive producer is Kirsten Garrett. I'm Wendy Carlisle, and you're listening to Radio National.
Hello, Michael McKenzie here, inviting you to join forces with Bush Telegraph on a new online project. Our much-loved Country Viewpoint has a new diving platform called The Pool, where you write about your life outside our cities and then post it for all to see. For more details, visit pool.org.au and keep listening to Bush Telegraph, weekday mornings from 11 on ABC Radio National.